This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if there's any question out there, why, don't hesitate to give us a call here at 408-464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And right now we have our producer here, and I'm just going to help him a little bit as we're preparing to get our special guest on for this evening. Fine, well, we got some numbers reversed there. I don't know how that happened, but we'll have our guest on very shortly. This is Mr. Bob Slimp, and we're going to be talking about what's really going on in South Africa. Now, you have to understand, I know a little bit about South Africa, having lived there, having practiced medicine there for a three-year period in the mid-1970s. In fact, I even had the unique opportunity of spending a part of an afternoon with the Prime Minister, all by myself. In fact, it's really a wonderful, wonderful story. I was the senior surgeon at the Pelonomi Native Hospital, as well as assistant to the professor at the National Hospital in Bloemfontein, both at the University of the Orange Free State. And we saw this movie one evening about this fellow who was going to kill the Prime Minister of South Africa. It was a South African-produced movie, but it was really a great movie, and I was watching that, and I said, you know, why can't I go to the Prime Minister of South Africa and just explain to him what's really going on, the fact that there are people within the United States who intend to destroy South Africa. At that time, I believe it was the Carnegie Foundation had already come out with a plan for a possible military invasion of South Africa. It was obvious we were going to do everything we could to topple the anti-communist government and bring the communists to power. And so I set out with my son, and we decided we would go to visit the Prime Minister. Now, at that time, he was going to be visiting, I believe, with Henry Kissinger and with Prime Minister Ian Smith. At that time, of course, South Africa was the major a vehicle by which Rhodesia was able to get supplies. They'd been embargoed by all the rest of the of Africa. All the other surrounding nations that had cut them off, so they couldn't get supplies through them, but they could still get supplies, oil, other things through South Africa. And so Prime Minister John Forster, that's V-O-S-T-E-R, but you pronounce it Forster, was at that time meeting with Ian Smith and, of course, later with Henry Kissinger. And so I just decided I was going to talk my way in to see the Prime Minister. Well, believe it or not, eventually I was able actually to do that. And ordinarily, of course, when you go to see the Prime Minister of South Africa, why, you are searched, you know, and he has just surrounded by bodyguards to make sure that, you know, you're not a professional assassin. But what really surprised me is I went to see him, I had my little satchel full of all sorts of books and copies of Foreign Affairs magazine, communist publications, and I was taken up in an elevator by a couple of burly South African special police. They brought me into the room where the Prime Minister was. They never once looked in my my briefcase there that could have been filled with, you know, grenades and shotguns and pistols, and they suddenly left me alone with the Prime Minister. And sometime I'm going to tell you the story about my experience actually sitting down with John Forster in this mammoth, great big room. You know, it's probably about 100 feet long, and there's just he and I sitting on adjacent chairs talking about the future of South Africa. But right now, we have with us Mr. Bob Slimp, and of course, he is very concerned about South Africa, puts out a newsletter about it. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dr. Spann.
Well, why don't we tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about then why you're concerned about South Africa, and then, of course, we'll go into the background of what's really happening in that tragic country as a result of America having brought comrade Nelson Mandela, a lifelong communist, to power, along with all of his fellow members of the ANC, who are also members of the Communist Party.
Well, Dr. Stan, my name is Bob Slamp. I'm a retired Army chaplain with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. I'm also a very recently retired minister, Presbyterian Church in America, and active in the pastorate until just over 2 years ago. I made a total of 14 trips to South Africa. I originally went there as a journalist for some American newspapers, and I went back, and eventually I took four tour groups to South Africa. While I was there, I met Dr. Varster, but I did meet Ian Smith. I did meet Dr. Jonas Savimbi. I met Chief Buthelezi. I met a large number of ministers. I met Dr. Trinict, Yatma Ray, members of the opposition. You'll probably remember those names well. And P.W. Berta, the former prime minister and state president. And I saw South Africa betrayed, both from within and by the West. And the only other statement I want to make at this time is apartheid is greatly, greatly misunderstood. Essentially, it was a plan to provide viable homelands or countries for all of the nations of South Africa, including the white Afrikaner tribe, and there was to be a constellation of southern African states with a relatively weak central government so that people could run their own affairs at the local level. It would be roughly analogous to the cantons of Switzerland. And so actually this was never really a matter of white versus black. But our Western leaders, including those who were in charge of America from at least 1961 onward, with the exception of the Reagan administration, were absolutely determined to turn South Africa into a one-party Marxist dictatorship. And they did that very, very well. They succeeded. The South Africans were literally talked into surrendering their country. And I think that South Africa is really a blueprint for what the New World Order has in mind for America, and what happened to South Africa is supposed to happen here.
And, you know, the most difficult thing, I think, for our listeners to realize is that our government intentionally and knowing toppled an anti-communist government and brought a communist government to power in South Africa, because most people, because they've been conditioned by the media, actually believe that the American government is anti-communist and that there really was this struggle between communism and capitalism, as it were. And yet, as you point out, it was the American government, along with the other Western governments, but the American government primarily, that brought communism to South Africa.
Yes. And, for example, there's no question that our government leaders knew that Nelson Mandela and probably a majority of at least the top leadership of the African National Congress were all communists. That certainly had to be known after the arrest of all of the prominent ANC leaders at Rivonia, just outside Johannesburg, back in 1963. And yet at that time, the CIA and the British MI6 were making efforts to infiltrate the South African political, defense, and church, and even sporting and athletic establishments. And tragically, they succeeded rather well, helped out by men like Harry Oppenheimer, who, of course...
Sir Harry, you mean?
Excuse me?
Sir Harry Oppenheimer.
Sir Harry Oppenheimer,
right.
Yes. Who...
well, of
was
course,
the... very much part of the conspiracy to destroy South Africa, and a very close friend of the Council on Foreign Relations, etc.
In fact, when I was there and living in South Africa, I actually was contacted by a member of BOSS. You remember the Bureau of State Security, which is the counterpart of the American CIA. And he told me, of course, that the Oppenheimers, of course, had not traditionally owned Anglo-American and De Beers, which are the two major corporations of which control 90% of the wealth of South Africa, but that the Oppenheimer, I think it was probably Oppenheimer's father, perhaps I may be mistaken on that, but he came to America, and he was given the power that he would ultimately wield. And, of course, that was the old Cecil Rhodes Holdings. That was the old holdings that went into creating the great fortune that created the Rhodes Scholarships and ultimately, of course, created the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States.
Right.
And that's what most Americans don't understand, and most South Africans didn't understand, and they thought it had something to do with the fact that Harry Oppenheimer had a Jewish name. Had nothing to do with the fact he was Jewish. It had to do with the fact that he was put in that position really to foster a feeling of anti-Semitism on the part of many people, thinking that it... that he was really the man behind it. He was simply a front man for other very powerful forces that were using him and ultimately would use South Africa for the stepping stone towards the establishment of this one world order that Cecil Rhodes had dreamed of.
Well, yes, I agree with you completely. He was part of the Illuminati. He was Cecil Rhodes and, of course, Harry Oppenheimer. Both men were intensely wealthy. But Harry Oppenheimer, at the time, 1960s, 1970s,
right.
early 80s, controlled the South African media.
Absolutely.
At least the English-speaking media, and through friends and contacts, much of the Afrikaans media as well.
And, of course, he controlled the industrial wealth of South Africa. And my friend in the Bureau of State Security pointed out that he had done an analysis, and between 80 and 90% of all the major corporations and mines and everything was controlled through Anglo-American and De Beers diamonds.
Right, Jack De Beers.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, Harry Oppenheimer says that in a speech before the American Council on Foreign Relations way back in 1960, now that we are in the second decade of the National Party government, they came to power in 1948, the conditions ask for a new approach. The heavy opposition which characterized the first decade of the National Party government is no longer expedient. And therefore, we are forced to change our plans. It is a twofold task, internally and externally. And he says that as soon as the air is cleared of animosity, we will pave the way for the fusion of the two white sections. It is, after all, the safest way to get rid of Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd. We must undermine him from within.
And I'm sure he was surrounded by covert agents of Harry Oppenheimer and the internationalists, just as even Chief Buthelezi was actually his closest associate, I understand, for some 20 or more years. It turned out I was actually a member of the ANC and recently defected. I don't know if you'd heard that, but...
entire... Encarta Freedom Party is moving into a coalition with the ANC, which saddened me very much. I thought that Buthelezi was his own man. And perhaps he was at an earlier time. However, in the case of Buthelezi, it may simply be, you know, Africans do not respect weakness. They only respect strength.
Right.
And when his plans for a Zulu nation totally evaporated, he realized that the whites were not going to resist the communist takeover any longer. The king, Goodwill, was the first to defect. That was followed by Buthelezi. I just wanted to mention that in April 1994, the Zulus were not even going to participate in the April elections. But during Holy Week, immediately prior to the elections, President Clinton dispatched a team of congressmen to Ulundi, the Zulu capital. And on Good Friday, the radical feminist congresswoman from Colorado, Pat Schroeder, Representative John Lewis of Georgia, pressured the king and Chief Buthelezi to participate in the election and accept the results in advance.
And it was a phony election. It was as phony as a $3 bill. Why they had, I think, 80 million ballots and there were only 40 million people to vote.
Yes. And
they actually declared Mandela a winner before they'd even counted the votes.
Yes. And there was tremendous vote fraud. But you know, in the run-up to the election, U.S. taxpayers, courtesy of a congressionally funded endowment for democracy, poured millions of dollars into the coffers of the ANC, Communist Party Alliance, for South Africa's elections on April 26, 27, and 28. And Bill Clinton sent Nelson Mandela some of his top aides, including Stan Greenberg, Frank Greer, and Bill Lynch. They actually spent weeks in South Africa spending U.S. taxpayers' money to make absolutely certain that the ANC Communist Alliance won the election, which they did by all sorts of dirty tricks, subterfuge, and vote fraud.
Right. And, of course, this is democracy. This is what we're pushing throughout the world, because we had an election. Didn't matter if it was crooked. We had an election, and therefore these would be the new leaders, completely losing track of or sight of the fact that America was never to be a democracy. It was always to be a republic with limitations placed upon the power of government. And this division of power, checks and balances, and what did we impose upon South Africa but a democratic tyranny, of which now, of course, is rapidly descending into chaos.
Yes, the economy is faltering. 24% of the people are out of work. Yet at the same time, the communist trade union, COSATU, continues to have strikes and work stoppages, and
That really doesn't make sense unless you understand that they want chaos, because out of chaos will come order. For when liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of liberty, and out of chaos comes order.
Yes,
but of course, with loss of freedom.
Yes, with a total loss of freedom, and I think that in the 1999 election, which is coming up in just a year, Thabo Mbeki, who is a communist and who will then be elected president of South Africa because Nelson Mandela feels too old to serve another term, is going to usher in an openly communist government.
But of course they have an openly communist government in Rhodesia now, and of course they've held off seizing the property of the white farmers until once they'd consolidated control of South Africa, then they could go ahead and say, now we're going to take the farms from the whites. They didn't want to do that earlier because they wanted the the white farmers, the Boers in South Africa, to believe, well, you can be just like Rhodesia. You can keep your property. You know, the government isn't going to impose anything on you. We just want a black-controlled government. We want a democratically elected government. And you remember, of course, what happened in Rhodesia when we forced an election there. They had an election, and they elected Bishop Muzorewo, who was a moderate black Christian leader. And our government said, no, we want another election. And then they got in Zimbabwe, who was a hardline communist. And since that time, there's been a one-party totalitarian state there. It goes through, of course, the sort of show of having elections every now and then, but there no opposition is allowed. And now they're beginning to seize the farms in Rhodesia. And, of course, that will just be a prelude to the chaos. In fact, I understand that things are really beginning to fall apart in Rhodesia with all sorts of demonstrations, even by the blacks, about what's going on. And
the blacks are up in arms because they want to live in freedom, and they are demonstrating against their government, and that's one reason that Mugabe is seizing the farms, a total of 1,734 white-owned farms. Have been confiscated out of fewer than 4,000 white farms. But you know, I cannot absolutely confirm this, Dr. Stan. I want to ask you if you have heard about it. I just received this intelligence from South Africa today, and that is the World Bank and the Monetary Fund are telling Mugabe that he is not going to be allowed to follow through because this will create such chaos that he will not be able to pay his debts, and he's going to have to abandon his plan to expropriate the white farms without compensation.
Now, I think the listener has to understand that the only productive part of Rhodesia today are the white farmers, and they actually are very productive farmers. They've been there for generations, and so they actually have food to export throughout the out Africa. And of course, you destroy those farms. Why you destroy the productive capacity of Rhodesia? And so, but the thing is, will Mugabe go along with the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank? Do you think he'll accede to their demands? Maybe he will if he's smart, or he'll end up very much like Mobutu did in Zaire, or as Allende did in Chile when he was the communist dictator of Chile. But, of course, he didn't go along with the system.
This shows you who the real rulers of Zimbabwe are.
Right, of course, the same people who rule
the world order.
Right, of course.
And these big international bankers, and if the communist puppets are not willing to toe the line, then they apply pressure. Now,
and sometimes they end up like Allende did, or like we've seen Patrice Lumumba did, or Trujillo in Central America, or even like Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, mm-hmm. did. When a leader doesn't go along with the system, sometimes they take him on a trip to Dallas.
Very, very true, Dr. Stan. I understand if that Mugabe is seriously considering now actually expropriating 10 farms, which Britain will pay for secretly under the table. And he's found another 60 farmers who are willing to sell their farms to the government, and apparently the World Monetary Fund or the World Bank, International Monetary Fund or World Bank will apparently pay for them, because the government of Zimbabwe certainly can't.
And I understood that faced with the seizure of about a quarter of the farms, the white Rhodesian farmers were saying, we're not going to plant any crops next year.
See how you like it.
And I think that this is one of the things, it's one of the rare times in history where a group of people have said, all right, if you're going to play hardball, we'll play hardball too. And the remaining white farmers said, we're not going to put any crops in. Let's see how you get by without us, Mr. President Mugabe, or Comrade Mugabe, or whatever you want to call him. So I think that that really is fascinating, that he is backing down a little bit from his threats. But I think that you're absolutely right. What you are showing is who really controls the world. In fact, today I've read an article about how the World Bank was giving instructions to the Russian leaders and would only continue giving them the large sums of money they need to continue existing and continue in positions of power if they gave in to the demands of the international banks. And, of course, for for our listeners out there who don't understand this, you need to get hold of the fabulous book written by Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, pages 324 and 325. It's all right there. How the central banks, working in concert through secret meetings to establish a feudalistic system by which they would control the governments of the world. And by controlling the governments, of course, they control the people within those nations.
Well, wasn't Carol Quigley, who incidentally was Bill Clinton's favorite mentor.
Right.
Doesn't he go all the way back to Cecil Rhodes and
yes, he does.
Rhodes scholarships?
That's really, really an amazing story, because Professor Quigley actually was researching the hierarchy of England, the ruling elite of England in the mid-1940s, shortly after the Second World War, and he ran into a man named Professor Alfred Zimmern, and Zimmern eventually told him he had been part of a secret society that controlled the English government between 1910 and 1922. And it was that information then that caused Professor Quigley to spend 20 years researching Cecil Rhodes and the secret society he created. And, of course, Professor Quigley never actually named in any of his publications Professor Zimmern as the man who told him of what had happened, but in his papers, I was able to get all of that information and all of his letters back and forth to Zimmern when they talked about who the original members of the secret society were. So we owe Professor Quigley a debt of gratitude for his expose of this secret society. And then, of course, we have a great deal of other information from, at least in part, from a man named William Stead, who was thrown out of the secret society, so he wrote about it. And when you talk about secret societies today, people, their eyes sort of roll back in their head, but history has always been one secret movement after another, people working covertly behind the scenes in pursuit of power.
But now, wasn't Cecil Rhodes, his outward society, of course, were the round table
right.
Clubs.
Right, but there was a secret
there
society.
There was something called the Lect that was his inner circle.
Well, he had basically, he had a secret society, and it had actually three levels. One was the Society of the Elect, one was the Association of Helpers, and I've forgotten, there was a third, there were three tiers. There was sort of an outer front group, the Society of the Elect, the Association of Helpers, and then the outer ring. So it was like an onion with various circles within it. And
I think the Round Table was the outer ring.
Right. And it eventually became the outer ring. The Round Table was really only organized after about 1908, 1909, and that's when the Round Table came about. And it came about when all of the young men who'd been in South Africa with Lord Milner returned then. Milner's kindergarten then became the foundation for the Round Table group. And their first publication of the Round Table magazine was back in 1909. But of course, it was really so fascinating living in Bloemfontein, South Africa, where you had Milner Boulevard, of course, named after Lord Milner, who was the man
yes.
who picked up control of the secret society after Cecil Rhodes' death.
And he was the man who began and was responsible for the Anglo-Boer War.
Right, of course
and
he was.
And the placing of the all of the Boer women and children that he could find in concentration camps, where 27,000 of them died.
He was an evil, evil man. And, of course, that's what everybody's missed about this whole story. What energized Cecil Rhodes and certainly Lord Milner and his followers, they came out of the occult. And, for instance, William Stead, one of the first three men picked by Rhodes, along with Milner and Lord Brett, was Stead actually came out of Theosophy and Spiritualism, and of course Lord Balfour in the next level came from the Society for Psychical Research, and the people who surrounded Milner all came, or most of them came, from the Society for Psychical Research, and we've got to take a break, but we'll be back in just a moment. Of our program, well, we've got to tell you that we're listener-supported, and if you agree with our message and would like to help us, why, of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can, of course, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters for a gift of $20 or more a month, and we'll send you then the four best tapes of the month, which I ordinarily pick. Of course, you can pick them if you want to, and, of course, we encourage you then to copy those tapes and help us to get information out that you're going to hear on Radio Liberty you'll never hear discussed anyplace. I mean, when was the last time you heard Rush Limbaugh discuss South Africa, the communist element of control, or the background of the Round Table and the secret society from whence it came? You're not going to hear this, and certainly nobody's going to tell you that the origins of this entire move towards world government came from the occult as we move from where we are towards a Luciferian-controlled world government. That's the message of Radio Liberty. We're fighting a spiritual battle on a political and ideological battlefield, and we will provide you the information and documentation so that you can help us to get that information out. But, of course, we need your help so we can continue expanding our efforts, and right now we're heard on 17 stations. We need to be heard on 170 stations. We need to have our message heard from sea to shining sea, to try to awaken the sleeping Christian leaders of America who seem more intent upon retreating behind the walls of their churches rather than taking a stand for righteousness in this time of moral crisis. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to join with us in what I believe is an epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation so conceived can long endure, why, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And you can join, and if you'd like to, put your pledge on your Visa or MasterCard, and we'll bill you on a monthly basis, or we can send a pledge in every month. If you get on the Visa or MasterCard list, why, we'll simply take you off if you call. And sometimes people will call and say, look, we got to get off for a couple of months. We got more bills than we know what to do with it. And we understand. We're all sort of in the same boat. But, you know, if you'd like to join with us, you'll get our regularly monthly newsletter. We'll keep you abreast of what's going on, and you'll be part of what we do, because my wife and I and my son and those who are helping us here at Radio Liberty can't do it without you. If you'd like to join with us, remember the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America, indeed, is under siege today. This is Dr. Stan, and I'm back with Bob Slimp, and we're talking about the tragedy of South Africa. Let's just talk a little bit about what's really going on in South Africa today, because the average American doesn't understand the chaos that we have wrought in that nation. And, of course, if we will bring that wonderful first-world nation, one of the finest countries in the world, into chaos, eventually, of course, what goes around comes around, and we'll see the same sort of chaos and destruction here in America. Why don't you tell our listeners what's really going on in South Africa today?
Well, I'd like to go back just a little and then immediately get to your question. South Africa was a magnificent first world country. It was one of the best success stories in the world. And for example, back in 1966, the economic growth rate was the second highest in the world at 8%. The inflation rate was 2%. The prime interest rate was 3%, both per annum. Domestic savings were so great that South Africa needed no foreign loans for normal economic expansion. And the living standard of blacks was rising at 5.4% per year, and that of whites at 3.0%. South African blacks had more automobiles, refrigerators, and telephones than all the people of the Soviet Union combined. They had more medical doctors than all of Sub-Sahara Africa combined, north of the Limpopo. It had more dentists, more attorneys, more more farmers than all of the other black nations of Africa combined, and illegal immigrants were entering South Africa at the rate of about 350,000-400,000 a year, because it was the only place on the continent where they could find work.
And of course, nobody was trying to get out of South Africa. Everybody
Absolutely
was trying to
not.
Get in. And it was, as you know, unjust as some of the laws were, certainly it was one of the most compassionate societies I've ever lived in. And of course, I remember we were doing open heart surgery at our black hospital long before this was readily available in most hospitals here in the United States. And okay. this was a black native hospital I was working in.
Well, I'm sure you've been at Barakwana.
Yes, there in Johannesburg.
And they had a marvelous, marvelous
right.
hospital, the largest in the world, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And but during this time, and this is what leads to the chaos, was the infiltration of the South African government, South African media, and as I mentioned when I was on your half an hour program about 3 weeks ago, when Dr. Verwoerd was prime minister, he recommended to his parliament that the big monopolies, including Anglo-American and De Beers, be broken up, because they controlled South African economy, and only if they were broken up would it be impossible for an international conspiracy headed by unfriendly governments and billionaire businessmen to interfere in South Africa's affairs. And for that reason, many, many people, including Dr. Verwoerd's wife, Dr. Verwoerd's daughter, many people who were part of his government, were absolutely convinced that the plot to kill Dr. Verwoerd was engineered by top American and British intelligence operatives, and many South African elite were involved in this plot.
And of course, that shouldn't be surprising at all, because we were killing leaders all throughout the world during those years.
Yes. Anton Rupert, a member of parliament and head of Rembrandt Liquors, was part of the plot. The editor of De Burger newspaper, the largest Afrikaans daily in Cape Town, was part of the plot. And my sources tell me that John Vorster was part of the plot. You might not agree with that.
I'm not in a position really to comment on it at all. I didn't live there at that time. I never
right.
met Dr. Verwoerd.
He definitely covered up the investigation of the assassination, and he was Minister of Justice.
Well, of course, we saw the same thing happen after the murder of President Kennedy here. Everything was done to cover up his murder,
right.
And I think the people who tried to expose what ended of what happened, there were about 120, 130 of them who ended up dead. I mean, you didn't dare tell the truth about what had happened to John Kennedy because you'd end up with some sort of a strange accident.
Well, there were many, many people in South Africa who met a similar fate. And there was a Robert Smith and his wife who were actually assassinated by the president of South Africa, the president of South Africa being a ceremonial position.
Right.
they were actually executed because they were going to expose this assassination, and they were also going to expose the fact that the Minister of Finance of South Africa took $10 million out of the country and deposited it in Grand Cayman and Bermudan banks. And at any rate, I know myself from talking with South African military officers in the late 1980s that they were being wined and dined at the American Embassy in Pretoria. They were being given very, very ostentatious and desirable gifts in order to attempt to buy their loyalty. At the same time, they were being told that if they resisted this communist takeover, the Western world, through the United Nations, spearheaded, of course, by American troops, would intervene. And I have heard that so often, all the way from non-commissioned officers through flag officers, that there is no doubt in my mind that this was taking place.
And of course, then America and America's great wealth and great power was being used to bring and spread communism throughout the world. And for the listener out there that says, that's incredible, how can you say that? Ask yourself, why is it doesn't matter whether the Republicans or the Democrats control Washington, D.C., we always give most favored nation treaty status to the brutal rulers of communist China who've killed between 60 and 80 million of their own people. Why? And of course, when you really understand what's going on, of course, the conflict between capitalism and communism is just something to keep the suckers in line, because you've got to have an enemy to rally people behind the government, to give them more power to protect our freedom. And, of course, what terrible things we have wrought in South Africa. So anyway, you were commenting that so many of the flag officers, so many of the people there said, we had no choice because we were told the Americans would bring in ground troops and, of course, crush us and destroy us.
Yes, they very definitely were told that. And now, actually, I think that they were being hoodwinked.
I don't think the American people ever would have gone for it. Maybe they would have. I mean, the American people are so brainwashed. They'd go along with an attack on Saddam Hussein. I don't know. I suppose they'd go along with an attack on the good people of South Africa if we were told that they were brutalizing people down there, and they'd use the same sort of stories they used to get the Americans into the First World War, these horrible Huns cutting off the breasts and hands of children and breasts of women and hands of children, just like that. Old Bill Clinton used the terrible stories of rape and murder in Bosnia to justify our taking our troops in there. You always have those atrocity stories to get the people behind your military adventures.
Yes. In this case, I'm not. The South Africans had such a marvelous military establishment and they actually had nuclear weapons, definitely.
And now, of course, they're in.
And now they've given them to Red China,
right.
And they've given the secrets to Iran.
Right.
But at that time, perhaps as recently as F.W. de Klerk coming to power, I believe that they could have easily defeated any combination of United Nations troops that would have come into the country, and I think the casualties would have been so high that even had the Bush-Clinton regime attempted it, the casualties would have been such that the Americans would have immediately demanded their troops be sent home.
But
of course, we would have taken thousands of casualties in an invasion of South Africa.
But the thing was that the television over there, the newspapers over there, the radio over there, everybody gave everybody a defeatist attitude, just as they're giving people in America a defeatist attitude today. And I hear people talking about, where am I going to run? Where am I going to hide? Instead of getting out there and saying, how am I going to stand for righteousness and for what I believe in?
No,
and for
people
my God?
Are running instead of
right.
fighting.
Right. Absolutely. And
that's
this is
true
the message
of America.
And we have to get this message out across America, because as you point out, what has happened in South Africa is a prototype of what's happening in America today. The disillusionment so many people feel, either that or the attitude, well, it just could never happen here because God would never let that happen to us because we're such nice people. And I don't believe God feels that way about America at all.
I don't either. I think we're being judged. And let me just, you asked a few moments ago, let me just say this about South Africa today. Before the takeover, I remember it was an old joke. I haven't heard this recently, but back in the late 70s and early 80s, when you flew into Jan Smuts Airport, the pilot would often say, you're about to land at Jan Smuts, set your watches back 40 years.
And
the reason for that was that the South Africans allowed no abortion. Divorce laws were very strict. Prostitution was totally illegal. There was no drug use allowed at all. That was stopped instantly. You couldn't bring a copy of Playboy magazine into the country. And you were searched to make absolutely certain that you were not bringing any of that sort of thing. South Africa entered the television age kicking and screaming only as recently as 1976.
I was there at the time, and it was the beginning of the end for South Africa. In fact, we came home shortly after that. Up to that time, our major entertainment was listening to the radio when they would have somebody reading from one of these wonderful, wonderful novels, Wilbur Smith or some of the other South African authors or English authors. And it was just like it had been in America 40 years ago.
Yes, and now prostitution is legal. They have the most liberal abortion law in the world, and including the legalization of partial birth abortions. Pornography is everywhere.
And AIDS is rampant throughout the land.
AIDS is rampant, right. Of course, homosexuality. You know, Cecil Rhodes is rumored to have been a homosexual.
He, in all probability, was.
And it may not quite be provable, but he almost certainly was. And so was his friend, Dr. Jameson. But today, all of these things are taking place in South Africa, and AIDS is totally out of control, and it's estimated that at least 12% of the population alive today will be dead by about the year 2005.
Right, and of course, and people keep talking about, oh my goodness, the population explosion in South Africa, throughout Africa, and of course, what's really happening is Africa, the continent, is dying.
Right, and in the meanwhile, the collapse of South Africa continues unabated. There's no money for anything, even police car gasoline. Hospitals are falling apart. School results are abysmal. Cocaine is now South Africa's favorite drug, unheard of under the old government, and corruption among government officials gets worse. They're even having a Bill Clinton-type scandal just last month. Former President F.W. de Klerk, who was nothing but a traitor, bought off by the CIA and MI6, acknowledged a long-standing love affair with a married woman. And he said, "I've fallen in love with another woman, and she with me." And de Klerk always posed as a very, very strong churchman.
What's happening to the church in South Africa? Because that's really the key to America is the church, the key to South Africa is the church. In America, it's been tried and found wanting. What's happening to the church in South Africa today?
Well, the church in South Africa has rejoined the World Council of Churches.
Well, you mean it's just gone from bad to worse?
Yeah, seminaries that as recently as 8 or 10 years ago were teaching biblical inerrancy and were opposed to the ordination of women on biblical grounds and this sort of thing, and saying that homosexuality was an abomination to God, that abortion was a violation of Scripture, are now like liberal American churches. And as a result, they are not being well attended, and many, many Dutch Reformed churches are simply closing their doors. It's estimated that at least 10% of all of the Dutch Reformed churches in South Africa have closed since the ANC and communists have taken power.
But of course, that's because they watered down the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yes. And so the church no longer stands for the gospel. There are a couple of exceptions. There is an Afrikaanse Protestante Kerk, which is headed by a Professor Willy Luba, which has about 50,000 members. They have their own schools, and they are attempting to proclaim the gospel in all of its power and purity. I won't say they're really growing, but they are there. There is one of the three Dutch Reformed churches, the Hervormde Kerk, the smallest of the three, with about 200,000 members, that is remaining true to the gospel. And many, many wonderful black clergymen are remaining true to the gospel. And the black clergymen who are being persecuted. Men
sure.
Like Dr. Isaac McQuena, for example, Bishop of the Independent Reformed Churches, which are approximately 4 million strong. There have been many, many attempts made on his life, and his brother and son have both been assassinated in attempts on his life. So Christians are being rather severely persecuted in South Africa.
Well, the time, do you foresee similar things happening here in America in sometime in the not-too-distant future?
Yes, the church is under severe attack, and the pastors, for the most part, are extremely complacent. We have many pastors, even in very conservative churches, who would rather be politically correct than biblically right. And some churches recently are trying to get overtures through their highest church councils in regard to women in combat, for example. It's one issue that I'm quite familiar with, and that's going to come up at the Southern Baptist Convention in June. It's also going to come up in my church, the Presbyterian Church in America, General Assembly in June. And
for or against it?
Very much against it.
Okay.
We believe that women and men should be separate, but there is a great deal of opposition to these resolutions. And many, many ministers are afraid to take a stand. They are simply cowardly. And there is Dr. Stan, a small group of coterie of businessmen in any really large church that attempts to prevent the pastor from preaching what the Bible has to say, because they know it's not good for business.
Well, that's a sad commentary on what's happening in the American church today.
And people are intimidated because the churches are being attacked by the media, by the world of academia, certainly, and by many politicians, and the church is simply retreating.
What about the fact that most churches are 501c3s, so they're really afraid to speak out on the really important political and moral issues of our time?
Yes. They shouldn't be. And, of course, let me say this, Dr. Stan, in all candor, and I think that you are part of this very much yourself. There are many courageous Christians who are speaking out and who are taking stands. But they are being persecuted, and they are having difficulties.
Well, but you have to do what's right.
But you've got to do it.
Sure.
To advance the good news of Jesus Christ, who is the only one who can save us, we must do it to please God, to be on God's side. Because the Bible commands it, and for no other reason.
Amen. You won't get any disagreement here. And, of course, I appreciate your willingness to speak out on these issues, because I think it's so vitally important that people understand that this first world nation is now simply a basket case, one of the most wonderful countries. In fact, I even seriously considered staying in South Africa. Right now, I'm awfully glad I came home, because I really feel that the battle for survival of Western civilization will be fought here in America and not in South Africa. South Africa's already lost. But I'll tell you, it really was a wonderful, wonderful adventure to live and work there, and with both the black and the white. It was really a thrilling experience, especially working with the black Christians, who certainly were so different in their outlook and their acceptance of me as a white man, you know, because we were all brothers.
Yes, and, I've known many, many marvelous black Christians. And through it all, however, there are these people who were willing to betray their country, betray their government. Blacks were bought off as well as whites.
Sure.
Very often, the communist terrorists were trained in mission schools run by Anglican and Catholic churches.
Are you suggesting that they were actually recruited into the revolutionary movement there?
Yes. Yes, because the liberal churches that proclaim the social gospel and proclaim liberation theology as early as the 1930s, 1940s, were radicalizing the students. By the decade of the 50s, they were actually teaching them Marxism instead of Christianity.
You mean the gospel according to Marx rather than Mark?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I think that most people do not understand that the forces of darkness have infiltrated Christianity, because it's far better, far easier to destroy Christianity from within than from without. Persecution strengthens Christianity, and of course, apathy and complacency destroys it.
And there were Nelson Mandela himself was the product of a mission school. And even as old as he is, I believe he's 78 now.
Right.
Already at that time, they were being taught, as you put it, Marx rather than Mark.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating subject. We're just this hour has flown by so fast, and I wish we could have another hour, but I have something scheduled next hour. Maybe we could get together again sometime. Why don't you give out your telephone number or your address, in case people would like to get your newsletter, because, you know, I'm sure that it will give them a tremendous insight, and we need to keep abreast of what's transpiring.
Well,
in South
I'm going
Africa.
To invite everybody listening to write me at, I'll say this very slowly.
Okay.
Bob Slimp, S-L-I-M-P, 4636, Crystal Drive, Columbia, South Carolina, 29206. 4636 Crystal Drive, Columbia, South Carolina, 29206.
Well, that's beautiful country back there in South Carolina. I'm going to be coming back there in about, about a month. But I won't be in Columbia, but that's a beautiful, beautiful city. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. And I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. And how often does your newsletter come out?
Well, it comes out monthly. And I'll be happy to send a copy to anybody who writes me.
All right, fine. And so that again is 4636 Crystal Drive, Columbia, South Carolina, 29206.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And of course, this is Bob Slimp, Pastor Bob Slimp, or Colonel Bob Slimp, but I guess just Bob Slimp for the time being. Anyway, thank you so very much for being with us, sir. It's been a real pleasure, and I've enjoyed so much the hour and a half we spent together, and I hope I can call on you again, because I feel a kindred spirit there.
Well, I feel a kindred spirit in you, Dr. Stan, and there's so many things that we didn't get a chance to talk about.
Well, if I may, I'll call you again, and we'll line it up again in the not-too-distant future. Of course, it's getting pretty late back there, and we do have something on the next hour. I wish we didn't, but unfortunately, I have no control over the schedule. It just sort of runs my life rather than my running it. God bless you, and we'll be talking to you later.
God bless you, Dr. Stan, and God bless all of the listeners.
Good night.
But stay close to the Lord.
Amen to that. Bye-bye.
Amen. Bye-bye.
Okay, and don't even think about changing that dial. We have a fascinating program coming at this next hour. We'll be right back.
This tape was obtained from Radio Liberty. Their mailing address, P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, ZIP 95063. God bless you now. Goodbye.